From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I love the science behind gardening, the stories that reveal what makes things tick in the natural world. A new book by Lee Reich called The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden, is loaded with such stories, and he's here to share some. First, though, these messages.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden. Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Lee Reich, or should I say Dr. Lee Reich, has degrees in chemistry, soil science, and horticulture, and is author of many previous books, including Landscaping with Fruit, The Pruning Book, and Weedless Gardening. But today, our topic is more about wondering and explaining not just the how-to, but the why and how things happen in those subjects and more. And I welcome Lee back to the show. How are you, Lee? Nice to speak to you.
Good. Hectic. It's spring. It's like there's so many things going on.
I know. You know, Lee, knowing you, congratulations, of course, on the new book, but knowing you all these years and your academic background, you know, I wonder if this was the book you sort of always intended to write and you finally got the chance to.
Well, I did intend to write it for a long time, and so I've been thinking about it a lot, and so the answer is yes.
Because it seems... just like, I mean, you know, the fact of using science for a much better garden kind of seems just like you. And the ever curious part, the ever curious gardener, is how I would think of you. So, yeah, okay.
Right. And it did hit me, as I said, okay, you know, repeatedly it was hitting me as I was doing things in the garden. And
right.
A lot of what I had learned in my academic settings have really influenced what I was doing.
Right. You know, the book has so many different, it's like these little stories, you know, lots of different stories. So it's not like a textbook, you know, where it's a chapter on it. I mean, they're not turgid and academic. They're kind of fun. And they have that human part. And like you said, you learned from what you were doing and you drew on your academic background to enhance what you were doing and so forth. So, you know, there were a lot of terms in it, you know, obviously, some of the sciencey words. And there were some fun ones that I knew, like double dormancy. I've used it myself, but I didn't know until I read in your book what the double is. What's double dormancy, for instance?
Well, that could be, for instance, tree peony seeds.
Mm-hmm.
They have a double dormancy. There's one dormancy that has to be overcome, and it means you have both dormancies have to be overcome before the plant can respond. So tree peony seeds have a double dormancy. One is for the shoot to grow. I mean, not the shoot, the root to grow first.
Right.
Which makes sense. And then the second dormancy is for the shoot to grow. So basically, you know, if you, obviously in nature, they don't read textbooks, plants.
No.
But they just do it naturally. But it might take 2 years for a peony seeds to germinate. But
right.
If you know about double dormancy, you can do it sooner.
You can outsmart them. But, you know, again, I knew what it was, and I knew some plants that had it and that you had to outsmart it, but I didn't know what the double referred to, you know, root and shoot. It was two aspects of its growth,
right.
You know. Yeah, so that was interesting. And then there were words like, I'm not going to probably say this one right, like totipotence, T-O-T-I.
You did not say it right.
T-O-T-I-P-O-T-E-N-C-E.
Right, totipotence.
Totipotence.
All powerful.
And what the heck is that?
Actually, that's one of my favorite ones because that sort of highlights the fact that, or it does highlight the fact that all cells in any organism except for the reproductive cells, you know, the sperm cells and the egg cells, have basically all the genetic information needed to make any type of cell. So even in humans, a cell in your eyeball is genetically the same as a cell on your skin, but just the way where it develops and how it develops makes skin versus eyeball. So same mm-hmm. with plants, Every cell has all the, except for the egg cells and the sperm cells, have all the information to make it any part of a new plant. So in plants, you can actually use this to, well, a lot of people do this, is when you take a cutting.
Right.
A cutting is just a stem, and then you take a cutting and you root it, and that stem, thing that was once a stem, could become a tree where it has roots, has leaves, has flowers, and has fruit. So basically everything happens there.
Right.
Which is one reason I really like propagating plants. I'm sort of addicted to propagating plants just because I have done it so many years with so many different plants, but I still find it so fascinating that you can just make whole new plants out of just a part of a plant. You could even do it from a few cells of a plant.
Right, like in tissue culture practically, right?
Yeah.
Cloning. And so say the word for us again that is the all-powerful.
Totipotens.
Totipotens. Didn't know, never
guess,
heard
I guess
it.
It would be more effective if I said that all-powerful, it has a bigger impact.
Yeah. And the thing about this new book about the ever-curious gardener is that, you know, it's not just knowledge for knowledge's sake, but as you were saying before, you know, it's useful insights and that it's problem-solving. So, for instance, there's one section about bulbs and how understanding the structure of a bulb can help you to, like, propagate it. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because that's not something, you know, that I knew either.
Yeah, so, you know, people take bulbs and then they plant them out and then, you know, eventually they might get crowded and you get new bulbs, you can separate them. But if you realize that a bulb is basically a stem compressed down and the scales of a bulb are like onion scales, those are actually modified leaves.
Uh-huh.
And on stems, so a bulb is a sort of a stem that's telescoped down. And on a stem, where each leaf is attached is a side shoot. And if you pinch out the tip of a stem, those side shoots start to grow. So a bulb, similarly, if you can, pinch out the tip of the bulb, side shoots will grow where the leaves are attached, which is the stem base of the bulb, or stem plate, it's called. And then you'll get a whole bunch of new bulbs quicker. So the way you can you might say pinch out the tip of a bulb is if you just take like a melon scoop or a knife and you just scoop out the bottom that gets out of the tip and then you plant that bulb and when you dig it up, you can have like 60 new bulbs there, small ones.
So that plate at the bottom that we think of as like where the roots are going to come out, right? Because we would order a tulip or whatever and a daffodil, and it's kind of dry and it doesn't have any top growth. But it has that, like, is it a basal plate? Is that what's down there, a plate?
Right, the basal plate. That's
right,
the,
okay.
That's so, yeah, so that basal plate is where the roots come out, but above it is the tip of the compressed shoot.
Okay, and so we're going to... Underneath there, we're going to do what? We're going to take a melon. I'm trying to visualize. We're taking a melon baller, and we're scooping.
Well, I've done it with a knife. We just sort of take out a cone-shaped hole in the bottom there.
Oh,
that's one way to do it. And another way is just make cuts into it. Sort of, if you had it upside down, you would cut straight down into it, like pie-shaped sections.
Oh, like score it.
Yeah, and then you just leave it in the replant it. And then you get all these bulblets that form, and then you plant. Then you take those out and you replant those.
So the injury, so to speak, that you inflict causes it to do this.
Just like when you pinch out the tip of a growing shoot, and it lets side shoots develop.
Wow.
Which is another discussion in the book about how stems grow.
Now, how long does it take for these bulbs to make these baby bulbs in this sort of injured area?
Just a one cycle thing, you know. One you injure it, you plant it, and then when you dig it up, you got a whole bunch of little ones.
And then those will take a couple of years or a few years to mature, right? To
flowering
age.
Yeah, because the bulb has to get enough energy to flower.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So we can use these kinds of inferences of like, well, what part of the plant is this? Is how you do other forms of pruning.
Yeah, and I did the little section I had on bulbs, I had in the stem section, because a bulb is essentially a stem.
Uh-huh.
And in the stem section, I also talk about ways you can redirect growth in a plant in the stems where it's more obvious, where you can pinch out the tips or cut back stems, and it actually stops the flow of a hormone that goes down the stem that suppresses growth of side shoots. But if you want side shoots to grow, you cut back the tip, and then you get side shoots developing.
So now with these bulbs, we're talking about true bulbs. We're not talking about tubers. We're talking
right.
So we're not talking about dahlia tubers.
Like, yeah, true bulbs like daffodils and hyacinths.
Okay.
But not things like potatoes or.
Okay. Okay. No potatoes, folks. I have a potato growing in my pantry closet that I just found. I'm doing an excellent job, by the way, Lee. You'd be very proud of my horticultural abilities.
Is that where you cultivate them?
No, I didn't mean to. I forgot about it all winter. Suddenly there was like this pink arm, you know, reaching over some other things in the pantry closet. And I was like, what's that? Looked like a spider.
And especially eerie since it's in the dark. So
I know. That's really funny. There was a section about soil, and you, of course, studied soil science as one of your multiple academic degrees. You were kind of a soil scientist at one stage in your life, officially, right?
Right.
And there's a section about hand texturing soil. Can you tell us about that? Because that was a real revelation.
Right. Well, the mineral part of the soil, which is the bulk of the soil, can be made up of various sized particles. So if they're large particles, it's a sand, which people know what sands are. You can actually see the grains. And at the other extreme, if they're very, very, very small particles, they're clay.
Right.
And if something in between, it's silt.
Right.
But every soil is not either a sand, silt, or clay. It's made up of one or more of those three components. And it's useful to know what kind of soil you have, because clay soils, you manage differently, and they have different inherent fertility than than sandy soils.
Uh-huh.
So one way to, and if you look in my book also, I have what's called soil triangle, which just gives a name to, depending on the ratio of sand, silt, and clay, you may have a clay sand. You could have a loam. A loam, by definition, expresses equal parts of the sand, silt, and clay, which doesn't mean it has equal parts, but it means the expression of the equal characteristics of sand, silt, and clay, and that's really among the ideal soils. But so it's useful to know what kind of soil you have, and the way you can do it is you take some soil and you just wet it a little, sort of like you're a kid trying to make a clay, or not only if it's a clay, but mold it.
Yeah,
and then you sort of press it out between your thumb and your forefinger, and it'll make a ribbon. And if it's if it's a soil that's very high in clay, that ribbon will really stick together like modeling clay would, and it'll make a long ribbon. And if it's high in sand, which doesn't really stick together very well, it'll just drop off. And also, you can feel it like silt and soil feels sort of silky. And the sand feels gritty.
Right.
And also when the soil's dry, you can feel it. Clay, when it's dry, will be, the particles are hard to get apart. It's like concrete. And sand, when it's dry, doesn't feel that different from when it's wet. So this is just ways that you can actually, and people, I'm not super good at this, but people that are trained in this and spend their lives just examining natural soils, this is how one way they can hone down pretty closely the amount of sand, silt, and clay in the soil. I mean, there's other ways to do it, too. Another thing I talk about is a sedimentation test, which is easy to do at home. Basically, you mix the soil with water, and by timing it according to directions of how fast things settle, you can determine it that way. And the easiest way is you just send your soil sample in for a soil test, and you'll get that results back. It'll say what it is.
Right. So when with the sedimentation. So because the sand, the heavy sand particles would drop out soonest, I assume.
Right. They drop first,
okay.
And then the silt drops next,
okay.
And then the
But the ribbon, and I think there's something to be said for hand texturing, even if you don't get it exactly right and you're not super expert, you know, at doing this with this small, what is like a tablespoon or two, a couple of tablespoons,
yeah,
in your, you know, that you've moistened and doing it, you know, if you imagine doing that, you're going to, as you said, get to know better really what your soil is like, even if you don't get an exact percentage.
Right. Yeah, it's just another one of these things in gardening besides, you know, observing the plants and thinking about and reading a lot.
Yeah.
Just doing all these things makes more of a connection and makes you a better gardener and I think a more interesting, makes gardening more interesting.
Yeah. I have some very old apple trees, probably, you know, 125 plus years old, that you've come and visited.
Right.
And they still fruit and so forth, but they tend to fruit in alternate years, or at least heavily in alternate years. And I read something in the new book that it talked about that you do thinning. You're a great fruit grower of many different kinds of things, and that you had some insights. You know, you mechanically remove some of the crop before it grows too big, and that there's some insights from that into, like, alternate bearing apples and how they needn't necessarily be alternate bearing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and first, the science behind that's very interesting and very simple at its grossest level. So inside a fruit, there are seeds, mm-hmm. and developing seeds in a fruit put out this hormone that actually suppresses flower bud formation. So, but the way apple trees and many other trees, most other fruit trees, fruit, is they make flower, the initials for flower buds, the season before the buds open. So this summer, apple trees will set down the initials for flower buds that will open next year.
Oh.
So getting back to the seeds, if you have a lot of seeds in a fruit, say you have a very big crop this year, yeah, that means you have a lot of seeds, which put out a lot of that hormone, which suppresses flower bud initiation,
wow.
that means next year you get very few. So some apples especially, like I have one apple that a lot of people are familiar with. It's a great-tasting apple, McCune,
yes.
or some people say McCown. So that tree is known for alternate bearing. So some years there'll be a feast and some years there'll be a famine. So the most obvious way to sort of even out that feast and famine cycle is to remove some of the seeds, which doesn't mean you start picking fruit and picking the seeds out. it means you reduce the crop.
This
and
year,
one way,
yeah.
Yeah, and one way to reduce the crop, which is one function of pruning, is just when you prune, you prune up branches that potentially were going to flower and fruits. That reduces the crop. But often, on apples especially, it's not enough. So then while the apples are sort of marble-sized, go along and you pick off some fruits. It
right.
turns out that for a full crop of apples, you only need 5% of the flowers to set fruit. And you would like to have maybe, you know, say 5 inches between the fruits.
Huh.
So, and each apple bud, flower bud, opens to 5 flowers. So you can imagine, you know, and sometimes the flower buds will be only a couple inches apart. So you can have a lot of flowers on the plant.
Right.
So, and then the final important thing about thinning the fruits is that the earlier you do it with, especially with apples, less so with other fruits, the earlier you do it, the more the effect. If you wait too long, then flower buds have already been initiated through the summer. So you want to do it early enough. And there's other benefits to the thinning besides just stopping the feast and famine. It actually puts more energy from the plant into fruits that are remaining so that they have more flavor.
Interesting. You know, some of mine sort of self-thin, so to speak, like clockwork. Do you know what I mean? They kind of drop.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another thing. The apple trees are not stupid, and that what they do is is early in the season, there's a lot of things that can, knock off the fruits. There's certain insects that come out early in the season. There's late frost. So the plants have evolved to actually set a lot more fruit than they even want to finally mature it. So what happens in apple trees and a lot of other fruit trees is it's called June drop. Mm-hmm. So they set all that fruit. They know it's extra fruit. Then they got the wherewithal to shed a lot of the fruits, which they do in June. Unfortunately, they're shedding it not enough for like good eating quality for us, or necessarily even bloom every year.
Right.
So we got to come along and thin out some more.
Okay. So we only have a minute or two left, and I guess I'm wondering what sort of crazy mad scientist experiments are going on over there at Lee Reich's farm den, half farm, half garden. Are there things that you're delving into more deeply now that you're trying to learn about that maybe, whether they're in this book or not, you know, that you're interested in particularly?
Well, it seems like there's always things like that. Charles Dudley Warner, who wrote a great book in the 1800s called My Summer in a Garden, mm-hmm. which is not totally a gardening book. It's somewhat political also. He wrote that I don't have the quote exactly, but basically what it says is some gardens are given over to experiments, so all they get is, so basically you don't get anything, but you get the experiment. So I always have to restrain myself from that because I'm always like, you know, testing this, testing that. You know, I remember when I started gardening and I didn't know anything about potting soils, and I wanted to make my own potting soil. And I had visited Elliot Coleman,
yes.
the well-known gardener, and he told me about what he does. Then I started reading every book there was on potting, you know, every section of every book on potting soils. And then I started, of course, like making up different mixes myself to see which one worked best, which other people had done also. So I don't know why I was doing it exactly, because no need to reinvent the wheel. But anyway, that's sort of the way my gardening goes.
Yeah.
But as far as currently, I'm sure there's something, but of course, put on the spot here, I can't figure out
okay.
what it is.
Okay, no, but so the experiment, I love that. I mean, I love that.
Right.
And the book, I'm glad that you wrote the book, because again, it really, to me, it's very much who I think of you as being. The Ever Curious Gardener is the name of the book. We'll have a book giveaway. Thank you, Lee Reich, for making time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.